Neo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music on the Air and in Your Ear. We are the Metal Nerds. I am the Crown Prince of Charisma, Mo. With me, the King of the Casters, Chief Defender of the Faith, Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, on a scale of 1 to a million, about how excited are you right now?
10.869 million, that is.
Million. And why is that?
Well, because I got to say that of all the guests we've had a lot of great guests, but very few have elicited the type of excitement that that our current guest has. This is one of those bucket list moments for me, I got to be honest.
All right, your bucket list guest. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jizzy motherfucking Pearl. I think that is the best way to introduce you, isn't it?
Sure.
Sure. Okay. Brett, why don't you kick off the questions?
All right. Well, Jizzy, first, we're happy to have you on the show. And let's talk the new album, All You Need Is Soul.
Okay.
You've decided to record another solo album. I mean, you've done a few solo albums before. It's nice to see you actually doing it on a real label for a change instead of the crucified one, so we can all have a good listen. So we like the album. Tell us about it.
Well, without being too boastful, I think it's the best record I've done since my original Love Hate Blackout in the Red Room record. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I would absolutely agree with that. I think for one thing that I would say it's probably the most consistent record that you've released in that time.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Sometimes records, even if they're good, they sound like a collection of songs. They just don't have the cohesion, and that's what I really dug about the Blackout record, is it really came from the same place. Every song seemed to fit like a puzzle piece, and I hesitate to say that's the same with this record. It really does have that consistency throughout.
Because one of the things in the case of Blackout in the Red Room that struck me, especially when I first got it, was the overall energy. I mean, it was just in your face and so immediate. And I think that that's something that I kind of got from this as well, is that, you know, energy but with a purpose.
Yeah, the difference between the Blackout record, if you think about it, that was a certain time, you know, that Sunset Strip thing, and the record really spoke to that. It was you know, the hard drinking, partying, late night shenanigans, you know, but it fit, and it wasn't contrived. It was real. I mean, that's what we were actually doing. You know, we were in our 20s and we were, you know, a bunch of hooligans, and it was great. But it came out in the music, and I thought that was cool. This record, I was trying to recreate the energy of the Blackout record without all the nonsense. You know what I mean? Because time's gone by, and you know, and I wanted the energy. I didn't want the hangover.
Well, I mean, you know, you're such an interesting person in that regard, because you're a I mean, what's the right way to put it? You're kind of like a bastion for living that Sunset Strip life. But at the same time, having read your books and stuff like that, I also know that, you know, that time has kind of come and passed. And so now it's like that idea of living in the afterlife of that.
Well, I mean, you get to a certain point and you can't burn the candle at both ends like that. I mean, when we had a series of tours and records during the Columbia Records days. I mean, we drank 9 cases of beer a night and stayed up all night and got up with 2 hours sleep and did it again night after night, you know, for 10 months out of the year for years. You know, I mean, which is not a big deal. Metallica does. They, you know, every band does it when they start out. They just, that's what they do. You know, it's a good time all the time. You know, but that was 30 years ago. I mean, you'd be dead if you were doing that now.
Or, yeah. I mean, Lemmy managed to survive for quite a lot longer than anybody anticipated, I think. But
well, he's kind of like Keith Richards. I mean, he was fairly indestructible. I mean, that guy, you know, he's in the Guinness Book of Drug Records. He's got about, you know, 4 or 5 pages.
Yeah, there's no question. He was a special person. Yeah, because you talk about the rainbow and stuff like that, and of course Lemmy was such a fixture there. And I guess it's imagining somebody else attempting to be a fixture at the rainbow would be kind of weird.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I mean, I wrote about all that stuff in my books, and it's inherent in the Blackout record. But the thing about my new record is that I went back to the Blackout energy and the vibe of it. You know what I mean? I'm not really writing songs about, you know, being a 20-year-old anymore, because obviously I'm not. So I just tried to recapture the vibe of what I really dug about that record. And I think I achieved it. We'll see.
One of the songs I actually wanted to ask about was You Don't Know What It's Like, and I was just wondering what your train of thought was when you were writing that one.
It's partly it's kind of like Rolling Stone Some Girls, and it's kind of a sarcastic take on the whole groupie thing. I do we even use that word anymore? It's 2018. I don't know. We call them regional representatives, maybe. I don't know what they call them now, but the point of it is it's just, it's about certain girls that will take a lot of shit from rocker guys just to be, you know, the girl on the arm. And it's just, it's kind of a sarcastic take on that.
So what are your, like, I mean, I'm sure you've been asked a million times, but like, did you choose the singles, or was that a Frontiers decision?
It was sort of a mutual thing. They thought that title track, All You Need Is Soul, was a very good lead off, because I don't know, I guess it sounds love hate-ish. And, my choice being Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone, which is kind of the kind of heavy pop, you know what I mean, and good chorus, and so, you know, I mean, it was kind of a mutual thing. There's a lot of closet love hate fans at Frontiers, I come to find out. The guy that designed my record cover is he fancies himself number one love hate fan. And that's the thing, is you find out that when you start interacting with people at the label, the inner fanboy sometimes comes out.
Well, I think You're Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone. It's the opening track on the album, and it's a great way to open it, because I mean, I think it really will please fans of your older work. You know, kind of grab them by the balls, and I think it's a great way to open. My favorite track on the album, I have to tell you, is When the Devil Comes. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
There's a couple of songs that were not written specifically for Frontiers. They were songs that I had. And there was a time when I was trying to write for television. A lot of rocker musicians try and write for these shows, you know, like the Wahlburgers and Duck Dynasty. All these TV shows, these cable TV shows, reach out to people for just background music or little bits of songs or little snippets, you know what I mean? And so I thought, why not take it, you know what I mean? Let's try a Western song. So I wrote that song on acoustic guitar, thinking that maybe I could get it on Hell on Wheels or, you know what I mean? Something like that. But come to find out that the snippets for writing music for soundtracks is about 47 cents. So I'm still waiting on my royalty check from pit bulls and parolees. So,
it must be interesting to try to find different ways to scrounge up money, hey?
Well, no, I'm just saying that's how that song was originally conceived. And then when I decided to put it on a record, I zepped it up a bit. I kind of, because I'm a big Led Zeppelin fan, so I kind of turned it into a little bit of Levy Breaks, a little bit of Physical Graffiti, you know what I mean? And sort of doctored it up a little bit. It is one of my favorite songs on the record. It definitely is got some twists and turns, and it's almost a 7-minute song. So, you know, kudos to me for keeping people's attention span for that long.
Well, like I said, I think it's fantastic. So I'm glad you did include it, because yeah, the length of it and like you say, the twists and turns, it's got it's like a good song is just more than just a good tune. It's a story, right? And it's got that story. It definitely has that going for it.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, originally the idea of the song was, you know, that whole visual hang 'em high, Clint Eastwood, you know, spaghetti western thing. And it was fun to explore that and not, you know, stick to the regular formula of chicks, beer and chicks.
Everybody's favorite in this kind of music.
Maybe I think you got to mix it up. I think maybe go beer, chicks and beer, and things
maybe,
will be all right.
Maybe next time. Yeah. That'll be the winning formula.
There you go. Yeah. I'll expect a little cut of those royalties then.
You'll get, 4.7 cents of them.
Speaking of royalties, actually, this brings up an interesting thing, because, you know, we're looking forward to talking to you, and we're, you know, seeking out your work, refreshing ourselves, listening again, doing some research and everything, and come across this website which has Crucified available. And Crucified is quite hard to find nowadays, and it has it available, and it's selling it literally for 15 cents a song. So I'm wondering if you get a big cut of that 90 cents if I buy all six.
You know, I wasn't even aware of that. that's the good and bad, positive and negative part of the internet, is that, that's why a lot of people do these VIP packages when they tour and stuff, is because, you know, there is no pot of gold for royalties anymore. For music, you know, that's just the way it is. And it took me a little while to get over that idea, you know, because musicians traditionally got paid for their music. And that really doesn't exist anymore the way it used to. And so, you know, it takes everybody a little bit of time to get over the butthurtness of the downloading thing that's here and is not going away. And Crucified, I guess, is up there in the, you know, ether somewhere, and someone's making 15 cents off of it. I mean, what can I do about it?
Yeah, it's insane. When I saw that, I was like, wow. You know, yeah. Brett, you had a question there.
Well, because we were talking about songs and stuff like that, and you had said that When the Devil Comes is one of your favorites. So what are the other ones that kind of stand out for you as being like those songs?
Well, I like a couple of them. I like the song Frustrated a lot. When I originally wrote that song, it sounded more like a punk rock song, and because of the way I can play guitar, but I'm not a guitar player. You know, I'm not great. That's why Darren Householder, the guy who played guitar on my record, he was able to take that song, which originally sounded like kind of a punk rock song, and he turned it into Van Halen Hot for Teacher, you know? And when I hear him opening on that opening riff, it grabs me every single time. You know, he is such an amazing player, and he was able to take what I gave him and make it so much better. And High for an Eye is another song like that. It's kind of AC/DC-ish. Well, very AC/DC-ish. And he just sounds great on it. You know what I mean? And it's killer.
Well, you definitely, you know, it's interesting because some of your other solo albums definitely do have a more punkish vibe. And you do tend to kind of straddle that line somewhat. So, I mean, overall, like, it's nice to hear you back with the with more melodic songs, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Frontiers obviously had something to do with that. I mean, you know, there is an unspoken thing that they would like to hear music in the vein of, you know, what you are classically known for. And some people think that's weird, but I understand it. You know what I mean? If someone is a Love/Hate fan and they grew up on Blackout in the Red Room, they don't want to hear my new solo record and I sound like Sting, you know, or Phil Collins or, you know, something like that. They want to hear something that is immediately recognizable and pleasing to the ear. So, you know, that's part of the reason when Frontiers approaches you, you know, they say, look, I mean, we'd really like, you know, for you to give us that, to give us what you got. And so that was in the back of my mind. I mean, I wanted to do it anyway, but it's nice to get a little shove in the backside. And so I thought that was a, you know, mutually a very strong and good idea. And that's why the record kind of sounds as good as it does, is because there is this intent of trying to try and recreate Blackout in the Red Room, obviously without, you know, stealing or copying, but to recreate that energy that you spoke of. So yeah, that was good.
Are you going to release another solo album on Frontiers and try to recreate the energy of the second album?
You know, the thing about my band is that, and it's weird, that this is my fifth solo record, and I would say it was my best solo record, definitely. You know, that's, a lot of artists proceed like that. Their first record is good. Their second record's better. Their third record's really good. Their fourth record's amazing. You know what I mean? Queen comes to mind. You know, I was a huge Queen fan, and it took them, you know, to sheer heart attack before they were in their stride, you know? And then after that was, you know, Night at the Opera, and that was it. I mean, they were gold. They were golden, I should say. So the thing about my band is that Blackout in the Red Room was sort of our best record. And then Wasted America was our second best record, and so on and so on and so on. And kind of a bummer. I wish it would have gone the other way around. Maybe we would have had a little bit more longevity, you know, and stayed together longer, maybe.
Yeah, I can imagine that it would be very. I mean, the timing was, of course, so very difficult as well. I do think that your sound probably meshed a little bit closer, but it's so easy to get pigeonholed, of course.
Well, what happened with the original guys, and this happens, you know, to bands, is that when you get married and when you have kids, your priorities change, and everyone asks, you know, well, what happened to those guys? Well, they moved on, you know, they moved on to kids and wives and real jobs, and music wasn't their entire life, and they didn't want to tour anymore because it beat you up, and they didn't want to be away from their wives, you know, for months at a time. And I totally understand that. You know, it's just, the older you get, the more of a conscious decision it takes to stay in the trenches, And that they opted not to do that. You know what I mean? It's not bad or good. It's just, you know, people grow up and move on. And we were never multi platinum. So there wasn't this incentive to stay together just for the money. You know what I mean? Because there wasn't millions of dollars. So everyone just moved on.
Yeah. Cause I mean, in your case, I mean, you've moved to Las Vegas and I mean, at least there's an interesting scene in Las Vegas, I think too, that probably helps you keep a little bit active. But when it comes to bands, I mean, Lord knows you've definitely been through a lot of them. And I think that's one of the things that draws me to you is the fact that you can go into these different bands and fit in nicely. And of course, I happen to like your voice, so it helps in that regard. But it's always like, oh, Jizzy's part of this band now. That's great. You know,
well,
I'm totally excited to hear that.
Yeah, you know, there's some people have a point toward like a negative connotation to that sort of thing. And I get it, you know, that, oh, he's a scab or he's just a fill-in guy or he's the guy that they get when the singer can't do it anymore or whatever. I mean, I get that, but guys like me, guys like Kerry Kelly, you know, friend of mine, guitar player, you know, people would make fun of him. And I thought, well, here's a guy that you lose your guitar player and you have a tour and Kerry Kelly can learn your entire set, 20 songs in 2 days. He can jump on a plane with no rehearsal, show up at your gig and play every note perfectly, you know, and what? That's a negative?
Yeah. I mean, you know, how can it be?
Not many people can do that. Robbie Crane, bass player, the same thing. You know what I mean? The reason he gets all the gigs is because he's got the chops. You know, the reason I can jump into these bands like Rad or Quiet Riot or LA Guns or something like that is because I can do it. You know, it's not a negative. It's a positive. You know, I mean, people talk shit on the internet just to talk shit, but I mean, that's how I look at it. You know, I don't jump into any band just because I have to be in it. It's like a girl that, you know, just has to have a boyfriend. So she'll just go out with anybody. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, for me, LA Guns music was great. I loved it. I loved being in that band. And Rat, I mean, Jesus Christ, I was on stage with Warren Demartini. I mean, how many people can say that? You know, it's just every time I went into a situation like this, I gained from the experience. You know what I mean? Tracy Guns is an amazing guitar player. We wrote together. We wrote really good songs together. I mean, I always took away from that a lot of life experience, and it was all good.
Yes. Yeah, there's that.
Go ahead, Nell. Go ahead, Brent.
Well, there's that great documentary called Hired Gun that Jason Hook did, which you know really sums up a lot of that. And so I think it's so interesting, especially from a fan perspective, to see the musicians that can just pack up and go at a moment's notice.
Well, yeah. I mean, it isn't. People call them mercenaries. They're not mercenaries. They're pros. You know, yeah. I know a lot of guys that are in my business and stuff like that. And they just, you know, you have to have your shit together. That's all. You know, oh, how do you sing so good after so long? How do you sound so good on this record? Well, because I got my shit together. That's why. You know, I'm not a fuck up. That's why.
Well,
I mean, it's pretty obvious. If I didn't have my shit together, I wouldn't, you know, that's not auto-tuned vocals. Those aren't tracks. I mean, that's the real deal, you know, and I'm proud of my songs and my vocals and my new record and stuff like that. I'm not afraid to boast because some people say, oh, this record is my Sgt. Pepper. You know, every band that comes out, they always, the cliche response is, this is our Sgt. Pepper. This is the best thing we've ever done. And I can say from experience that this is the best thing I've done, because the other records aren't as good.
You know, it's funny because like nobody would ever say or should say like you know, you talk about somebody like the Wrecking Crew, right? I mean, they played on any number of albums, but I mean, they were never really coming out with their own stuff. And so, I mean, yeah, like the idea that, that somebody is a mercenary, that's just completely wrong in that kind of case.
Well, I mean, it's no big deal. I mean, I take it all in stride. Everyone talks shit.
Yeah.
Everyone talks shit on the internet, you know. Oh,
that's what it's for, someone, I guess.
Well, people put out a record and they put their heart and soul into a record, and then, you know, oh, it sucks. Oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's, you know what I mean? And it's just, you got to have a tough skin to be in this business. You just do. I mean, people talk shit just for fun, and you can't, you know, let it affect you. I mean, I've written a million bad songs, so I think I know what good ones sound like. So, you know, that's why I feel proud about my new record and I'm not afraid to boast.
It's actually interesting. Do you think that the internet is causing people to be more negative, or do you think it was always this way? It's just that you didn't hear it because there wasn't this, you know, medium to get it out there that people were talking shit when they didn't need to.
I think a bit of both. I think the reason, you know, people talk shit is because they can. I mean, obviously, you know, you go on. I mean, think about if Jimmy Page was on Facebook. Can you imagine?
Oh, God.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just saying. I mean, can you imagine just people bitching at him? You know, did you really write Stairway to Heaven? I mean, after, you know, I would log out immediately. You know, so to me, it's just the nature of things, of the way things are. It's, to me, YouTube is a way, it's just, you have to be good. You have to keep your shit together. You have to, the bar is raised with YouTube. You know what I mean? There's nothing worse than some performance that makes you cringe. That's up there forever and ever and ever and ever. So, you know, I always, my live shows and every time I just assume that I'm being filmed. And so I try and do my best and I because YouTube is harsh, you know, especially now, because people have these phones that record in HD, you know what I mean? So they just, everything is record quality shit, if it's shit. So
it kills me, though, because I, you know, we go to concerts, and it kills me to watch these, I assume millennials, I'll say millennials, but how it feels like they have to watch a concert through their phone.
Yeah,
they can't annoying. Possibly do it any other way.
It's annoying, and I've noticed that when guys, musicians, sort of bag on it, they get shit for it. You know, well, we paid, so we can do whatever we want, blah blah blah. I mean, I get it, I totally get it, but where's the joy in being in the moment of the performance and stuff like that? I always say that when, you know, people record something, snippets here and there, I get, you know, it's cool. You know what I mean? They're, you know, but when they record the whole show or whatever, then they're kind of taking me home in a doggy bag. You know, they're not really enjoying the performance. They're going to bring it home and watch it, you know, on their computer. I mean, where's the fun in that?
I always look at it in that regard as I kind of go back to the David Lynch's Lost Highway and say, like, I like to remember things my own way, how I remembered them, not necessarily the way they happened.
Yeah, I mean,
it always feels like that to me.
It's the internet. There's nothing you can do about it. So I have stopped bitching about a lot of things that annoy me. I don't want to be that guy anymore. I just want to put out music and have people enjoy it and tour and have people dig it and live my life and, you know, pet my dog and it's all good. Oh, and love my wife.
Well, that brings up...
And love my wife, she says.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well,
I agree. I also would put the dog first, personally. That's just me.
No.
That's because you don't have a wife, Mo.
Wife is first, dog is second, guitar is third. Is that what you're saying?
Well, wife is first when she's in the room, right? But, no, obviously no wife right here. Just a dog looking at me. Now I want to pet her. Excuse me. Brett, you had a question.
Well, I'm interested because a while ago you had your website kingjizzo.com and then jizzypearl.com, which now is something completely different in that regard. And I'm kind of wondering why you let those go in that regard, and mostly what's up with jizzypearl.com.
Well, yeah, that domain name sort of got hijacked. I let it go. I don't know, for whatever reason. I don't know why. But it got hijacked by some guy. And so he's kind of a fan, and he's kind of doing his own thing. And people bring it up to me like it's mine and like I'm somehow behind it, but I don't have anything to do with it. I mean, he kind of speaks about me sometimes in this sort of a Zen, metaphysical thing, like I'm some character in a comic book or something. But I don't know. It's out of my hands. You know what I mean? I let the domain slide, and so I guess I'm to blame.
What? Yeah, because I just remember
it is a good it's an interesting website. What he's doing with it is interesting, but it's strange because, you know, I mean, he references you and the band and so much, and yet you don't know if what he's saying is true or not, if his sources are true or not. He's trying to do something good. Yeah.
It's like Wikipedia. It's the same thing. I mean, how do you regulate that shit? You know, it's just anybody can, it's just weird, sterile analysis of one's career. And it's just very, I don't know, it's just odd. You know, it's very robotic. And I don't know. I guess I just don't dig it because when I liked Led Zeppelin and The Who and Black Sabbath and stuff, you know what I mean? I didn't want to know what they had for lunch, you know, and I certainly didn't want to see pictures of their lunch. You know what I'm saying? I dug the mystery of Led Zeppelin and the castles and the hobbits and the, you know, all the shit that went along with that. You know, it made the music larger than life to me. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons that music isn't as vital or vibrant these days as it was, because the internet, you know, you can just Google someone and find out everything about them, their age, their stats, does he have a mole on his back? You know what I mean? It's just, it demystifies the mystery, and it takes away some of the music, you know what I mean? It's weird. It's odd to me.
Well, it's interesting because like I always kind of refer to it myself as like the chase is better than the catch because I mean, back in those days when you wanted to find an album, you had to go looking for that album. You couldn't just go on the internet and buy that album and download it, what have you. I mean, there was a record store. I mean, we live in Canada, right? So, I mean, that meant that it was even harder for us to go to a record store because they didn't have a lot of the great imports and stuff like that. So, I mean, half the time, anytime I traveled to the U.S., it was great because I would wind up coming back with, like, 10 different albums because it's like, oh, this is great, Nitro. Wow, I can't get Nitro in Canada. This is awesome.
You know, but actually brings up an interesting point. Like a story you have, Brett, about this. But I just want to mention, you know, because talking about the demystifying them, I used to look at people and say, that guy's a rock star. And it was just like, that was like, oh, I want to be a rock star. And I just said, like, wow, he's a rock star, a fucking rock star. And now I look at them and go, he's a person. And there's some good things about that, but some not so good.
Yeah. I mean, but there's this weird schizophrenic thing of people use the word rock star, the bar set very, very low for that term.
True.
And yet they also talk shit and knock you off your pedestal at the same time. I go to England the year to tour. My band is still very popular there. And they get it. You know what I mean? They don't treat you, you know, like you're on Mount Olympus or anything, but they respect the music so much that there's just this killer relationship of, you know, we're here to see you and we dig you and you, because we know that you dig us. And it's great. I love it. I wish it was like that everywhere, but at least it's like that somewhere.
Yeah, I suppose there's a lot of bands out there who kind of find their little, their locational niche and tend to go back there a lot. I mean, certainly in Europe, there seems to be a lot of that kind of thing, even more so than the States, that's for sure.
You know, there's a million bands. There's a million bands. And,
yep.
And people have the, you know, short attention spans. But it's cool. You know what I mean? You still have to put out a good record. You still have to look good. You know what I mean? You still got to do your thing. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, it's just for your own good. You've got to be good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, hey, as long as somebody wants to see you and as long as somebody wants to talk to you and remember you and that kind of thing, then I would think that's a good thing. Yeah. But what I was going to get at earlier is that, as far as the chase is better than the catch for me, is that when it came down to your books, because I remember there was a time when your books came out, and again, physical copies, I wasn't able to really get them when they came out. And then I found out that they were coming out on Kindle, and I was very excited, and I went to buy them, and they were only available in the United States on Kindle at that time. And so I wound up actually traveling. We had rented a vacation property, and so there I am on the internet on my tablet filling out that property's address as my current address, completely fucking up my Amazon account, but I was successfully able to buy your books at the time, so I was very pleased.
That's a fan. That's a fan, no doubt.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, it's cool. I have a Kindle too. I dig it.
So what are some of like the best fan interactions you've ever had? I mean, I'm sure the fans are what keep you going to a large degree, right? Right. The love of music and the fans.
Well, the love of music, you have, I guess it isn't really the love of music. It's the passion to want to do it. And that's different from the love of music. I think everybody loves music, but what keeps you going and to have longevity is you have to have the passion to want to go in and rehearse and write. And if your song isn't good enough, go back and rewrite. I mean, yeah, that's what really counts. That's soul to me is having that passion.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you put it like that because I mean, there's so many people that I hate it when people seem like they're just doing it by rote. And it's just because that's the only thing that they can do, so they just keep jamming out music. But I am intrigued by like people who are still recording albums to this day, even though it doesn't necessarily get them someplace. Like, what are your expectations for this album?
Well, short-term goal is to help my tour, which starts on May 2nd in the UK, and I do 19 shows. My short-term goal is to do that. My long-term goal is to get more festival dates in Europe and expand and get more work out of it and have people dig it, but obviously to expand the horizons.
Yeah, because I think when you talk about the tours and stuff like that, I know we've heard from a lot of people that it's very difficult to tour. And so I think that might be one area where being on Frontiers is kind of a benefit. Like, what's it like to tour in your case?
Well, I mean, I've toured my entire life. You know, I've toured on a bus, toured in a van, almost toured in a rickshaw.
Ooh.
You know, it's just what you do. I mean, bands tour, you know, everybody has to do it. It's the only way nowadays it's the only way to make money, you know, and survive. So, no big deal to me. I mean, I do it and I enjoy it. I just try and do it in a way that doesn't beat the shit out of me. You know, long drives, no sleep, bad bar food every night, jalapeno poppers. I mean, it's just that's a young man's game. That's kid stuff, man. When you're 20, when you're in your 20s, you can do that 7 days a week and bounce back. But the older you get, you have to, you know, you have to have a little bit more maintenance.
So are there things like cruises that I can't remember if you've been on any of the cruises?
Yeah, cruises are fun.
What do you think of?
I like them.
They seem like a great way to be able to interact. I'm actually fascinated by the interaction. Like, we haven't had the opportunity to go on one yet, but fascinated by the interaction between the musicians and the fans. In that case, is it? Do you get chatted up a lot, or is that one of those
generally
cases where
it's, generally where it's... the first day of the cruise is when all the when it's chaotic with the autographs and stuff like that. You know, people bring everything that you've ever done, every magazine clipping, you know, and it can get a little crazy. But then they get all their stuff out of the way, and then the rest of the cruise generally is pretty painless.
You know, that's really interesting for sure. You know, it's one of those cases. I like the fact that there is ways for things to be out there so that people like us who are fans of the music can get the chance to go see them. I mean, again, it's one of the issues with living in Canada where we do, and that we don't get a lot of the big festivals, and so you have to travel a lot more.
Yeah.
But it's nice that to know that they exist in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, the cruises are cool, you know, and they're definitely fun for people, fun for musicians as well, because it's comfortable, you know what I mean? You're on a boat, 24-hour food and booze, it's killer.
Yeah, no need to take a tour bus for that one. That'd be the worst cruise ever, is trying to use it to take a tour bus for a cruise.
Yes, indeed.
Wondering, kind of back in the day when you're the house band at Whiskey A Go Go, can you kind of tell us about the personality of the bar itself? Kind of fascinated by that era, you know, we didn't get a chance to really experience it the way we wanted to. And, you know, it's there's so much kind of legend behind the Sunset Strip and the time that you were there. What were that band, what was the personality of that bar and compared to other bars?
It was the place to be on the Sunset Strip. It was the place to be. It's hard to articulate something in that time. You know what I mean? It is something that you would have to be there to understand. Kind of like someone that was at Woodstock, you know, in 1968, trying to describe what Woodstock was like. You really can't. You know what I mean? Well, it was muddy. You know what I mean? You know, I can't really describe it to you in a way that you would understand. I mean, it was everyone dressed the same. Everyone looked the same. Everyone flyered. Everyone partied. You know, people got record deals. You actually thought that it could happen, that you could actually get a record deal, and, you know, there was magic in the air. So it was a great time that will never, ever return.
No, I mean, it can't, and it's sad that it can't return. I mean, I guess it's odd because there's still, you know, the, like, record labels are still taking advantage of people, I would figure, but yeah, like that idea that a record contract at that point really meant something.
Well, you had radio, you had MTV, you had tour support. I mean, people dogged the record companies, but they spent a lot of money. You know, I mean, it was a good time. I mean, I was on a $500,000 bus. You know, I didn't pay for it, any of it. So it was, you know, and all the videos and everything. I mean, a video costs $100,000. You know, that would be a cheap video. I mean, just, you can't imagine the kind of difference from then and now you know, a record contract was $1 million. You know, now it isn't.
Did you, what about shooting videos? Did you enjoy the experience? Have you, is it something that, that you like, something different, or kind of, is it a pain in the ass, but something you do? And did they ever come to you with any video ideas that you thought, what the hell are you talking about? Like just something just completely whacked.
Well, people would do treatments of your song. For example, Why Do You Think They Call It Dope or Black Out in the Red Room? There'd be a couple of people sort of bidding on it, and they would write a treatment, say a 3-page treatment of it. And we would pick the guy that we thought was, you know, more in tune with what we were trying to do. And that's how it was done.
So do you have any, well, I mean, obviously you have lots of great stories. Now, I guess one of the questions that we, that was on our mind to a certain degree was Data Clan and the name, like how important is it to, for the name of the band to be good?
Well, don't they say band or brand? The brand, yeah, is the brand is better than the band. The term Love Hate was a song we had, and Data Clan, that was just a, that was the band that those guys had before I joined, and it was a different kind of music. It was very, I don't know, dancey, Duran Duran-y. It really wasn't, you know, hip. And then we changed it to Love Hate, and that seemed to make more sense for us because there was a lot of love and a lot of hate in the band, a lot of conflicting emotions, and yeah, that's what happened.
Well, and there's no question that you've that it has managed to stick with you for your entire career, which is you know, because even the new album, of course, has the Jizzy Pearl of Love Hate on it, so. So it's just kind of, because I guess you're not going to tour as Love Hate anymore?
Oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. I might change my mind tomorrow. Who knows?
Yeah, you'll just be like the Kiss and the idea of a farewell tour that's, yeah, not actually a farewell tour.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. I that's what I need. I'm all out of anniversaries, so I need a farewell tour.
Just get a little Gene Simmons action going, and life will be great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's this is our scheduled time with you, Tizzy. So we want to thank you again so much for coming on. It was you know, real pleasure to talk to you. Really, it's a lot of interesting insight. I learned a lot, and I you know, really do appreciate your time. We have a little tradition, something you're probably familiar with. We like to tell people to plug their shit, and it's that time. Tell everybody one more time about your new album and when it's available, where they can get it, what it's called, everything.
Frontiers, May 11th, Jizzy Pearl, All You Need Is Soul, comes out May 11th. I have a tour starting in the UK May 2nd, going for a month. Festivals at the end of the year, more festivals in 2019, playing the Whiskey June 22nd, other gigs in the year. But yeah, the record's coming out. I think people that dug the old Love Hate are going to really dig this one, and it's called All You Need Is Soul.
Great stuff. Thank you very much, and it is a terrific album, and we hope everybody checks it out. And with that, we're OUT.